This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Most history students will eventually learn about the Nazi period of the early 20th century and about the Holocaust. They will learn about fascism, Hitler, the persecution of Jews and other minorities in Nazi Germany, and about the death camps. They will learn about events, learn names of the key players, and come to understand the horror of the period. They generally won't learn or think much about music and how it was impacted by Hitler's oppressive Nazi machine. But thanks to the Charlotte Symphony, they will, and in the process will understand how something we take for granted as a benign source of pleasure can also be seen as dangerous or manipulated for political reasons. The Symphony has embarked on a program called Music and the Holocaust, and several of the people involved in bringing this part of history into schools are with us for the hour. Gene Cavadlo is the principal clarinetist with the Charlotte Symphony and founder and leader of Viva Klezmer, an ethnic music ensemble that has performed all over the Southeast. Welcome back to the program. I think you've been on the show before. Welcome back, I think.
Thank you, Mike.
If not, welcome for the first time.
Well, it's nice being here. Thank you so much.
Chris Stunnell is the manager of education for the Charlotte Symphony and is co-creator of the Music and the Holocaust performances. Thank you for being here, too.
Thank you.
And since this program has roots in the Violins for Hope program that was brought to the area by UNC Charlotte's College of Arts and Architecture, they are involved in this effort as well. And Dr. Jay Grimes is here. He's an associate professor of musicology at UNC Charlotte and the world's foremost authority on the Hungarian musician Ernst von Dohnányi. Close?
Close, great.
Okay. A forgotten hero of the Holocaust resistance who was later falsely accused of Nazi war crimes. Dr. Grimes' book about the Violins of Hope, by the way, will be published early next year by HarperCollins. Thanks for being here.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
I know that the Charlotte Symphony, when I said this, Music for Holocaust program has roots in the Violins of Hope exhibit. We did a program on that exhibit and on that concert series when it was in town. How did one inspire the other, and how does this program differ from what people got out of the Violins from Hope? Chris?
Well, for the Violins of Hope program last year, we came up with an educational component. We wanted something that we could take into schools to kind of excite people to get them to come to the exhibit and also to enrich what they would see at the exhibit. And with working through UNCC and with the educational team, we decided to do something that brought in live music, kind of tied with narrative and images. And so we came up with this, with this format of a program. Well, the program was very successful. I mean, there was a limited number of slots we could perform, mm-hmm. and every single one of them was filled up within a week. And so it was very well received. And then Violins of Hope ended at the end of last year, and I was planning what to do this year for our programs. I said, this was a really well received, exciting program, so why not continue it? It doesn't have to end when Violins of Hope ended. So I, contacted UNC Charlotte and said, hey, would you be interested in kind of rewriting the script a little bit and making it more general, not so much focused just on the violins, but on music and the Holocaust in general.
For people who did not hear that program, did not see that exhibit, did not attend any of the concert performances, we should remind folks that Violins of Hope is centered around these instruments that were played in the death camps and saved somehow. One of them was actually played on this program. And the stories surrounding those instruments and how they came to be in the death camps, who played them, what kind of music was played on them, and what occasions they were played. It was a really powerful exhibit, and that went to schools too, didn't it?
Schools came in to see the exhibit.
They came to you. This is a side of history that really isn't frequently discussed unless you're in some sort of music history class, it seems to me. The Holocaust is, but not music around the Holocaust. And given the importance of music in our lives and the fact that it's everywhere we go now, do students tend to connect more easily to this or to be more affected by this when they hear the stories and hear the music than if they just heard the cut-and-dried stories that we normally hear in a history class about this period?
Yeah, this is Gene speaking. I would say that the music draws them in. When they hear the music, it's something very tangible, and it's something that they can connect to. Mm-hmm. And we have had a great deal of success just gauging our success by the reactions of the students when they hear the music. I mean, they do get excited about.
That's really interesting to me because it's not anything close to the music that most of these young people experience in their day-to-day lives.
That's true.
I mean, some of it could be tied. Well, some of it's classical. Some of it could be called old fogey music, I suppose. And some of it is ethnic and very foreign to these kids' ears, and yet they find it exciting.
Well, it's very lively. It's dance music.
Well, why don't we hear one of the pieces that we're talking about being lively? And since you are the klezmer aficionado, we're going to begin with let's talk about klezmer music before we hear the piece, because you have this Viva Klezmer group.
Yes.
What is klezmer music?
Yeah, well, klezmer music is actually instrumental folk music of the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
It was used at Jewish festivals, bar mitzvahs, weddings. And it ranges in emotions from unabashedly sentimental to unabashedly joyous.
And you begin your presentation to kids with this particular piece of music. Why this piece of music? Because there's lots of different klezmer music.
Yes.
Why this one?
Yes. Number one, because it's lively, and it gets their attention. When they hear this, all of a sudden, their ears perk up, and they're hearing something that I think they can relate to,
mm-hmm.
because they can sense that this is music that is danceable, and it's joyous,
mm-hmm.
and they can move to it, they can dance in their seats, they can clap to it, and it focuses the audience on what we're doing.
And what is this piece of music called?
The music is called a Freilach.
Is that a type of
music? It's a type of music. There's no name to the particular piece of music,
okay.
but it's a generic name.
Well, let's hear it now. Let it play out with us. This reminds me of obviously folk music, of European folk music, but at the same time, it has elements that you will hear in early 20th century American music of the 1920s. Is that because we stole it from that folk genre?
Well, this music,
the little Kit Kat symbol and things like that.
Yeah. The music has many influences.
Uh-huh.
It's got gypsy influences. It's got influences from other ethnic Eastern European music, and in turn, it did influence some early American music.
Now, this is not your group playing. Tell me you have.
That's
accordion.
Right.
You have an accordionist?
No, we don't.
Oh,
and I was going to congratulate you. I was going to say, boy, you guys have done your homework. I know it's not us, but it sounds darn good.
Well, I know Viva Klezmer also sounds darn good. I think an important part of this project between the college and the symphony is to provide live music. It's one thing to have these sort of dry facts. Those are hard to wrap our minds around. But having music living and breathing in the classroom is a very essential aspect
Absolutely.
Of the educational process.
And it also sounds like the kind of music they would have put under early sound talky movies for chase scenes.
Sure.
Yeah. And obviously that comes from the Jewish influence, because the Jewish
we're always being chased.
Well, that too. But what I'm saying is that the people who made those films were Jewish.
Yes. A lot of them.
Early
were.
Studio heads.
That's
they
right.
were Jewish.
That's right.
Where does this piece of music date in terms of the chronology of the period?
That piece probably came out of the late 1800s, I would say.
Wow.
late 1800s.
And the kids' reaction to this when you kick off the program is what?
Yeah, they're into it. I mean, they're it's hard for us to sit still when we hear it. They're dancing in their seats. And when we finish, they're cheering. They're absolutely cheering. They're clapping wildly and screaming, and we have to quiet them down. We have to bring them down a notch.
Of course, you go from that and you start getting pretty serious because you start talking about the Holocaust and all the things that dealt with music in the Holocaust and how music was dealt with in the Holocaust. When you put this program together, where did you start?
Well, good question, because it's such a massive subject. You know, our idea was to kind of take it chronologically. You know, obviously we started with, mm-hmm. with the Freilach that we just heard, mm-hmm. A really exciting piece. And then we started with then we go into music prior to World War II. You know, we're the Jewish culture, the Jewish music that was rich and popular during that time, and then take it into to the Nazi regime, and then what was music was considered degenerate. And so we play excerpts of music that, although it was popular in America, was outlawed in Germany. Things like Gershwin, right. or jazz music.
Which we'll talk about.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then from there, we moved from there into music that was performed in the camps, music that was written in the camps, music written and performed in the concentration camps. And then on to close the program, we then end with a piece, the show that's a modern-day klezmer piece, to show that the Nazis did not kill that tradition, did not kill that music. It still survives today. And new Freilachs and klezmer music is still being written.
Were there other periods, Doctor, that music was either used as part of the machine, the political machine, or stamped or tried to be stamped out by the music, by the regime? Were there other periods other than just the Nazi period?
I can't think of a single time when it was so systematic and wholesale. This government-sponsored adoption of music as a way to control thought and to control people.
Do you understand it? I mean, how can you identify a piece of music as being subversive? What criteria could you possibly use for that? It's easy to do that for a piece of theater because there are words used in that, and the words can be subversive. How do you do that with notes?
Well, it's difficult to rationalize it because we're not talking about rational thought.
Right.
And so we have a long history of, in this period at least, the German authorities saying things like, jazz is bad. It has a negative influence on German culture. It becomes something of a whipping boy for – this is why we lost World War I and how it suffers so much
because
now.
Because of jazz?
Because of outside influences. Germany looked back at its rich heritage of musicians from J.S. Bach mm-hmm. through Mozart and all the way through Wagner. And all of a sudden in the 20th century, they're faced with – they're no longer at what everybody's looking to for what great music is.
Right.
What caused this? And – arbitrarily, they decided it was these outside influences. And so part of this is a mission to get rid of all non-German influences on German music in their desperate attempts to restore themselves to this greatness they've created in their heads.
What was the music scene in Germany just prior to Hitler's rise? What was it like? What kinds of influences were permeating the culture at the time?
Well, the Weimar Republic had a very rich musical scene in many aspects, and these are the days of Arnold Schoenberg and figures like that who became the poster children for bad music, mm-hmm. What they would call the formulaic, the 12-tone process, and the Jewish international influence, as they called it, on their music that they saw as harmful.
We have to take a break. We're going to play a few more examples of the music played during this program of music and the Holocaust with our guest today in just a couple of seconds. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru in Gastonia, presenting the new 2013 Subaru models, including the XV Crosscheck, an all-wheel drive crossover built for all-terrain and fuel efficiency. More information at TyndallSubaru.com. 20 years is a very long time to spend in prison for something you didn't do, for a murder you didn't commit, and that is Daryl Hunt's story. He's a free man today, largely through the efforts of the Innocence Project at Wake Forest University, which helps prisoners prove their innocence through DNA testing. Still, it took him 10 years after they discovered that DNA testing proved that he was innocent to get him free. We'll meet Daryl and talk to his attorney Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, frustration over sequester-related air travel problems, the latest on the Boston bombing investigation, and five presidents helped dedicate the George W. Bush Presidential Library.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about music and the Holocaust and a program put together by the Charlotte Symphony and by UNC Charlotte to teach about that in the schools in this area. Chris Stanell is with us. He's the manager of education for the symphony. Dr. Jay Grimes is an associate professor of musicology at UNC Charlotte. And Gene Cavadlo is the principal clarinetist for the symphony and the founder of Viva Klezmer. And I guess you're the ringleader of the band they take on the road to the schools for this project. Is that right?
I guess you could put it that way. Yes, yes. And we were bandying around the term Freilach earlier, and I should probably explain what that means. A Freilach is a Yiddish word, actually, and it means lively or happy. And it sort of describes the character of the music when you hear it. And we explain that to the students in our program. After we play the Freilach, we introduce them to that word, and we tell them what it means. And to drive the point home that this is music that was considered degenerate, we ask them what their favorite kind of music is, and we get all kinds of answers, you know, from hip-hop to rap to Latin sometimes or rock. And then the next question is, how would you feel if the government were to pass a law telling you that your favorite kind of music was degenerate? And that if you listened to it or played it, there would be severe penalties for that. And that usually elicits a reaction.
Gets their attention.
Yes, yes.
Because it's difficult to understand the kind of oppression that people went through in the Nazi Germany until you bring it home and relate it to things that we can experience today. Is this a unique way to teach this, or is this something that we've just found another way to teach this? And not a unique way, but another way. Is it unique?
I think it's unique. I mean, in a classroom today, they're not equipped to have this kind of a program. And you know, there's so much teaching facts. As I mentioned earlier, World War II and the Holocaust is such a massive subject that there, you know, the amount of time they can spend on it in a high school or middle school classroom, it's just not enough to get through everything.
Right.
And especially in education these days, the big thing is differentiation. You know, teaching different styles, from bringing in multimedia, bringing in music, incorporating other things into your lesson so it's not just lecture-based. And this is a neat way to bring the Holocaust to light, so the kids can kind of they can personalize it a little bit more, because they hear the music and it helps them put themselves into the shoes, you know, of the Jews of that time period. Especially as Gene mentioned about this way, asked the kids at the beginning about their style of music, favorite style of music was band, and you know they immediately connect to it, and so they're hooked at that moment throughout the rest of the program, and I think it helps them see the Holocaust and see what these people went through in a different light.
You include several different pieces of music in the course of this program, and I know that you have to leave at 9:30, so I want to get to this piece of music now, Gene, because I want you to be able to talk about it, because you include in your list of songs a contemporary piece written by Academy Award-winning composer John Williams, and it's the theme to Schindler's List, which I think is one of the most beautiful and haunting melodies I think I have ever heard.
Yes.
Let's listen to a bit of this. I'm going to talk about why you include this in your program.
Thank you.
Itzhak Perlman playing violin there. Why is this piece of music in this presentation? Yeah. Because it's not contemporary to the period. It's contemporary to our period because of the film.
Yeah, and I have to give a shout-out to my good friend Carlos Tarazona, who plays this piece with us during the program and has probably played it more often than any other violinist in Charlotte. But to answer your question, I think one of the purposes of our program is to get across to the students the idea that we need to have an appreciation for each other's culture. And perhaps if we had more of that, the Holocaust might not even have happened. But what we try to do during this program is to point out how varied the culture here in Charlotte is, and how we have to learn about each other's cultures in order to appreciate each other more. And we are teaching the students something about Jewish culture during this program.
Was this written for this movie? Or was it written for Mr. Perlman?
I'm sure it was written for the movie.
Of the three of you here, maybe somebody can explain this. Bring this up a little bit, Wendy. Explain to me why this is achingly beautiful. It is. It's achingly beautiful, and it's perfect for the film. It's perfect for the story that the film tells, yes. Schindler's List. But what is it about the music, the notes, the way it's played, that elicits that response from people?
I think, first of all, it's written in a minor key, which a lot of Jewish music is in a minor key. And there is something about the melody and the tonality of it that speaks to the Jewish soul.
And it's played on a violin, which is the closest to the human voice.
Yes. Yes. All of that. And it's difficult to put your finger on exactly what it is about the music that speaks to the Jewish soul, but it's become a very important piece of music in Jewish culture. I think partly because of its association with the movie, Schindler's List, but also because of the music itself. Even if it wasn't associated with the movie, I think there's something about the music itself that sounds Jewish.
How is the music for this program, which much of it is contemporary to the actual period that you're talking about, how was it chosen? Who chose it? Who made the decision?
I did.
Okay.
I guess I did. Yeah, and it was chosen with a narrative in mind. You know, we wanted to, first of all, let the students hear what this degenerate music sounded like. That's why we open with the Freilach. And we want them to hear what music that is used for a Jewish celebration sounds like. That's why we do the second piece that we do on the program, which is called Chuzen Kala Mazel Tov.
That's easy for you to say.
Sometimes. Which is a piece that's traditionally played at a Jewish wedding.
Right.
Parents of the groom, parents of the bride, congratulations. I think everybody knows what Mazel Tov means. And of course, the Gershwin medley is just to let the students know that there were some very important composers, American composers, who happened to be Jewish and composed music that was accepted universally throughout the world as great music. The same thing with the Baimir Bis Dushain, which is a piece of music that became popular all over the world, even in Germany, until they found out that it was written by a Jewish composer. And then the final piece that we close with, that the what's called a bulgar, which is another type of freilach, written by a contemporary Jewish composer, just to show students that the Nazis did not succeed.
Yeah, they were not successful.
The culture survives and thrives.
Gene Cavadlo is the principal clarinetist for the Charlotte Symphony and also the founder of Viva Klezmer and the the man who put together the music portion of Music and the Holocaust, which is a joint effort of the symphony and UNC Charlotte that tours the school. I know you have to go to rehearsal now, so I'll let you go. But thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. It's been great.
Don't let the door slam on the way out, because people will know that we're in a room with doors. As the Nazis gained a stronger foothold in Germany, they began to exert influence and censorship over a lot of different artistic endeavors. It wasn't just music. It was the visual arts.
Absolutely.
It was theater. It was film. What was that all about? Was it just simply that they had in their minds what their culture should be like, this rigid, very defined attitude about what their culture should be like?
I think a lot of it goes back to the propaganda that they wanted to get across to the people. They wanted to present this Aryan Superman, you know, pure German bloodline, and anything that didn't fall in line with that, you know, was considered evil or wrong. So I think that's a main part of just that propaganda. They wanted to bring German culture in line with Nazi ideas, and any artistic expression that conflicted with those ideas, they wanted to suppress them. And anything that challenged their position, you know, was considered degenerate.
Was there pushback? In that society, did anybody push back at the time, or were they too afraid to push back?
Well, a famous example is Richard Strauss. That's who Goebbels picked him, a famous composer, picked him to be the first head of the Reich Music Chamber, which was, you know, to regulate all of the music in Germany. And Strauss, you know, used his position as a way, one, to save his daughter-in-law and grandchildren who were Jewish from being sent to concentration camps, but also he wanted to try to protect music of Mendelssohn and Mahler, who were Jewish composers, and then in Hindemith, who was banned just because Hitler didn't like the music of Hindemith, try to keep their music in the forefront.
So there's a sense that if we play along, we can manipulate the system from within.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Then there's also the feeling among many Germans, Jews and otherwise, who believe this is such a ridiculous concept mm-hmm. that it can't possibly last. So we just sort of hunker down for a few months, maybe a year or two at the most. This whole Nazi thing is going to wire it over, and things will return back to the way they were.
Right.
It's impossible. Only in retrospect does this seem like a fait accompli.
Right.
At the time, it's just like the rest of us, people going about their daily business, hoping for the best.
The conditions in Germany that gave rise to Hitler were terrible. The economy was in shreds, and they were embarrassed by their defeat in World War I, and they were made even more embarrassed by their defeat by the way the Allies in World War I treated Germany at the end of World War I. So when Hitler rises to power, I won't say he's a breath of fresh air, but he gives them pride in being German again, and they really thought that this was just a passing phase, many of them, right?
Hitler was able to really tap into the basest instincts.
Yes.
And I don't think there's anything uniquely German about it. I think in this, what we can learn from this period is the absolute extreme. It can happen. But I think what we need to learn about this period is that's sort of part of humanity.
There are echoes of that today even in our own society.
Yes, it's easy in times of desperation to start pointing the fingers away from ourselves first and then at specific groups.
If there's a devil you can eliminate and things will be better, then by gosh, you're going to eliminate that devil, even though the devil is trumped up.
Unfortunately, I think that's part of humanity.
And he went after not just Jews. He went after gypsies, the Roma culture. He went after homosexuals. He went after who else?
The
Sinti and
even Germans who had medical conditions or were mental.
Yeah, the weak, the deficient.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And also people they called asocial, meaning people who did not agree with him politically.
Right.
Really? That's what that meant? Okay. There's another example, and Gene mentioned it a second ago, of this piece of music called "Bei mir bist du schön," which was a major hit record in the 1930s and 40s.
The Andrews Sisters, 40s. Yes.
The Andrews Sisters had an enormous success with that, and that success went into the 50s. People still played that record in the 50s, but it went all over the world. It was so popular that I'm told that the Russians claimed it as their own, even though it wasn't theirs. And it was popular, as Gene mentioned, in Germany until somebody revealed that it was composed by a Jew, and then it was banned.
That happened actually quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And there were so-called scientists who were sitting there going back and revisiting everybody's genealogical records, and all of a sudden, one day someone's perfectly acceptable, and the next day, because they have a grandfather who is Jewish, that's it for that person.
I mean, this is bordering on madness when you take it down to its basic structure. And when you present this to kids, and I know they learn a little bit about the Holocaust and about that period in history in their world history classes, I hope. I'm assuming they do. Do they?
They do.
Okay. But it's probably in the abstract until you start talking about things like this, a song as benign as "By Me, Mr. Shane." I mean, what when you look at the faces that you – because I think you present this, don't you?
Yes.
When you look at the faces of these young people when you're talking about this, what do you see coming back at you?
Shock. I think they had no idea how to quantify what was going on. I mean, they read about it. They hear about it. To them, it's ancient history.
Yeah.
But then when you play music that's more accessible to them, you know, tuneful music like that piece, you know, they start to realize, wow, this, you know, it's wasn't as long ago as I think. I mean, just mentioned that, you know, the last Andrew sister just passed away recently.
Right.
So it's not – there's not that far of a connection to that piece. And so then, you know, the kids start connecting. Well, what if – so my music was gone. How would that make me feel? And I think it really gets them hooked into the subject matter.
Yeah.
Something Chris said earlier was it helps them personalize the experience. I think also humanize. Mm-hmm. It's sort of easy for us to get wrapped up in the data, you know, 6 million lives. It's something I personally can't comprehend.
Mm-hmm.
But I can comprehend being a single human being and loving music. Even though if we're listening to music I've never heard before, it's some music someone else's loves, I can personalize that because I know what it's like to enjoy music. I was talking to Alexia, one of your associate producers, and she was talking about visiting the Anne Frank house. This was pre-Justin Bieber. And, and they had a CD there of the music that Anne Frank would have listened to as a young girl. And we think about, you know, this is a real person. I know what it's like to love music. And these are individual human beings.
And Justin Bieber would have been declared degenerate by the Nazi regime. Speaking of which, the word degenerate, did that just mean it's Jewish so we can't have it? Or was there something else at play? Were they going through some sort of – they have a list of criteria that they use to describe what is and what is not degenerate. And can you answer that in 10 seconds? Probably not. We'll come back after the break and get an answer to that with Dr. Jay Grimes from UNC Charlotte and Chris Dunnell with the Charlotte Symphony. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting an evening with Lyle Lovett and his acoustic group, The Modern Embodiment of Texas Music, in the Belk Theater, Monday, May 6th. Tickets at blumenthalarts.org. Frustration over sequester-related air travel problems, the latest on the Boston bombing investigation, and five presidents helped dedicate the George W. Bush Presidential Library. That's all many of the topics they'll be discussing as journalists gather around the table for the weekly news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes, the National Hour first at 10, the International Hour at 11. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE. Or online at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
You can find the latest news the instant it happened.
Today's big story is always just a click away.
Yet that story leaves just a few questions unanswered.
Like, what does it mean?
Is it really new?
How does it affect me?
Who are those people in the news?
And what about life in the rest of the world?
I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Find answers to those questions when you wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition, weekdays from 5 till 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. With us, Chris Stanell, Manager of Education at the Charlotte Symphony, and Dr. Jay Grimes, Associate Professor of Musicology at UNC Charlotte, talking about the Music and the Holocaust series of programs produced by the Symphony and UNC Charlotte that is taken around to the schools to kind of humanize some of the atrocities of the Holocaust, to let kids of this generation really understand what took place and what the rationale behind it was. And we were talking just before the break about the word degenerate and how they would say that's degenerate music and it's banned. And if you play it or if you listen to it, you can face severe penalties in your life. Did they have a set of criteria for what that was, or was it simply Jewish music?
It wasn't simply Jewish music, this idea of degenerate, or entartete is the German word. It's sort of anything that's extra German, and therefore they quantify it as anti-German. So it's Jewish music and African-American music. Jazz was making a huge splash, not only in the United States, but in Europe at that time.
Yeah, you show a very offensive slide in the course of this to illustrate what they saw as African-American music. And I hate to say this, but I'm going to say what it is. It's a monkey playing a clarinet.
Right. And if you look closely on the lapel, the monkey is wearing a Star of David to show that, you know, one was going to make that connection between Jews and African Americans, that both are.
What's the reaction to that by young people?
There's
foreign to them.
There's a gasp from the crowd when that slide comes up, because a lot of the population we perform for are African American students.
Sure.
And I think they didn't realize that they were also lumped in with Jews and there's that same feeling towards their race as well. So I think seeing that, once again, it goes back to that personalization.
Well it's they're dehumanizing,
right,
is
right.
What they're doing.
Right.
And so what this project is doing is, in many senses, rehumanizing.
Right.
Right. What was the penalty if you were caught playing or listening to the – do we know what the penalties were?
I mean, it could be imprisonment. You know, the Gestapo could rough you up a little bit, send you home, or it could be even sent to concentration camps. And I think it depends on how much of a repeat offender you were.
And Chris mentioned the Reich Chamber of Music. There's a Chamber of Culture there, oversaw, and there's a Chamber for Visual Art and other things. And theater. And they controlled everything. They controlled who got to perform, and then they controlled what they performed.
Wow.
And so this level of censorship precluded a lot of performing of non-censored, non-accepted art. And if you played it, then you're kicked out. You don't ever work again.
Right. And you had to be a member of the chamber. You couldn't just perform on your own. You had to go to them and get approval.
It's a tightly controlled union. And, of course, if you're Jewish,
you
can't
join.
Get in.
Right.
A lot of the people who were persecuted were allowed to leave or left early before they closed the borders and before they started the camps, and we benefited from that. People around the world benefited from that because
Absolutely.
A lot of those people came here, a lot of those musicians, a lot of those artists.
The intellectual migration, Albert Einstein, Arnold Schoenberg.
Right. How many of these musicians arrived on our shores, and was it difficult for them to get here? Because I know that we didn't encourage this sort of immigration at the time.
I mean, some of it depended on their standing. There are some who are very, very famous or popular. They were able to come over immediately for jobs. They were in demand, you know, like a Kurt Weill. Others, you know, they waited, had to wait for the right time. Like a director, like Kurt Garon. You know, he wanted to come, but he never could get. And Kurt Garon was probably the most famous movie director in Germany at the time. You know, he never could get the deal that would for him to want to come over to the United States. There was never enough money to bring him over, and unfortunately, he ended up, you know, being sent to Tracy instead.
In the early days, the idea was just to rid Germany of the Jews. The final solution that we later see that wasn't in place early on. It was just let them leave. In fact, there's many ways where the Germans facilitated them leaving.
Right.
But to leave, they needed employment, gainful employment elsewhere. So there were, in all art forms, the very top percent was able to find work in the United States or Canada or Australia or
because as we all know, lots of artists don't work. They can't get work because they're independent contractors and they can't get work. It's tough.
And it compounded with all these immigrants, an already very tight workforce was getting oversaturated.
We were in the middle of the Depression.
Right. Yeah.
So if you didn't have a skill and a job, you couldn't come here and add to the unemployment rolls. In your presentation, Chris, you talk about the importance of the role that many of these musicians played in the development of what has come to be known in this country as the Great American Songbook. We're talking about people like George Gershwin, his brother Ira,
right.
Jerome Kern, Harold Arlen, who wrote Beyond Somewhere Over the Rainbow, for crying out loud. And Irving Berlin, who wrote God Bless America and White Christmas. Talk about that.
Well, I mean, a lot of them came over prior. I mean, it was still for similar reasons, but it was by prosecution in Russia during the pogroms. But I mean, really, if you look back at the history of, you know, Tin Pan Alley songwriters, I mean, even Richard Rodgers, or I mean, almost all those early songwriters have Jewish roots. And, you know, you think about, gosh, they didn't come over. Where would American popular music be? Where would Broadway musicals be? Such with the Gershwins or in Irving Berlin. I mean, it's quite amazing.
During the communist period in the Cold War, many artists from the Soviet Union would tour and have the brave notion at some point that they were going to defect, and so they would claim asylum in the countries where they were performing and not go back to the Soviet Union. That happened here too, didn't it? With a lot of these people, they would be able to leave the country with their families as touring musicians and not come back. Is that not true?
I know in the story of the comedian harmonists, who are a popular vocal group in Germany at the time, I know they did an American tour, and while they were in America, I think some of them decided to stay, while the rest, then half the group went back to Germany. I can't remember if they all stayed but I know there was discussion of trying to defect and stay, but I don't know how widespread it was.
Here's the perverse part, at least to me, of all this. While the Nazis were trying to stamp out certain degenerate music, or music that they saw as being degenerate, they insisted, they encouraged music in the ghettos, yes. The Jewish ghettos that they formed, and in the death camps that they sent Jewish people to.
Yes.
What kinds of music were played by those musical organizations in those areas? Was it this forbidden music, or was it something?
Well, when you're looking at the ghettos and you're looking at the camps, you're really looking at two different, completely right. different situations. In the ghettos, for example, the Warsaw Ghetto and others, it was just a way of sort of to control the population, keep them busy, give them just enough where maybe they wouldn't uprise. And so in that, still, they would control what types of music could be played. In the camps, it was something quite different, in that whereas in the ghettos, there were orchestras and things in the larger ghettos that were performing for other residents of the ghettos, in the camps, very often, the orchestras were playing for the Germans. And so they ended up playing German marches and things like that to instill order as the work details would leave camp every morning. There'd be these bands playing marches, and then they'd be playing when the workers came home in the evening.
And they would play sometimes near the extermination chambers, be they ovens or gas chambers. Why would they put them up there and make them play?
It's a form of musical torture, to use music as a mocking gesture, and we see that throughout various camps and various experiences. And I think that's, as a musician, one of the very hardest things to wrap my mind around. And they would. There's an incident in Sachsenhausen where they'd make, while they were torturing Jewish prisoners, make them sing these very silly German songs, pro-German songs, knowing it was antithetical to what their actual feelings were, but it just sort of pleased the sadistic guards to, while torturing these people, hear them sing these jolly songs.
Or to create a fake sense of normalcy, playing music while they're lining them up, just to make them feel more comfortable, less likely to attack and less likely to uprise. Having music played, and they're getting off the trains, hearing music, thinking, well, maybe this isn't going to be as bad.
Calm them down. Right. Yes, there's an element of culture here. So how bad could it be?
At first, yes, I think that unfortunately very quickly learned the ugly truth.
How many orchestras were there in these camps? They had lots of them, didn't they?
There were. The most famous examples were those in Auschwitz. And, of course, when we're talking about Auschwitz, it's a large facility with several camps.
Yeah.
So in the main camp of Auschwitz I, there was a 100-piece or so orchestra, very prominent. And then in Auschwitz II-Birkenau, there are actually four orchestras, one for each subcamp, one for the men, one for the Romas, one for the women, and one for the Czechs. And there are several additional ensembles in even more of the subcamps, including, by the way, ironically, some jazz orchestras that the Germans put together. And it just goes to show it's very difficult to rationalize irrationality. So although it was clearly degenerate in their minds, they still liked it. And so when they had the power over their little dominion of this subcamp, they would put together a little jazz orchestra for their own entertainment.
How did you get to be in one of these orchestras? As you were brought in on a train, on a cattle car, and they discovered, first of all, you were allowed to bring your instrument? Is that it?
In the very earliest days, yes, but ultimately, no. The first thing you did at Auschwitz was a selection. And it's those who can work and provide service on this side, mm-hmm. those who are of no use to us on this side, and then those people went straight to the gas chambers.
So if you were a musician and were good enough to play in one of their orchestras, was that a fair – not a fair, but was that a pretty – was that a guarantee that you would avoid extermination?
Not a guarantee, depending on the orchestra as well. The women's orchestra had a very famous conductor, Amel Rose, probably of all the Jewish musicians we're looking at, the one who had the most international prestige.
Yeah, the niece of Gustav Mahler.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the Germans really respected her for her artistry and allowed her to protect the women in her orchestra. And so there was actually an unspoken rule, mm-hmm. actually a spoken rule, you don't mess with the women in Alma Rose's orchestra.
In your program, you use a piece by Chopin, his Nocturne in C-sharp minor, as an example of a piece of music that saved the lives of two different musicians. And we're going to talk about those musicians in a moment. But first, let's hear a portion of that Chopin piece. Because of their performances of this piece. Talk about that, Chris.
Well, in the case of Natalia Karp, she was at Plaszow, which is the camp famously in Schindler's List. And she was actually asked by Emon Gert, who once again was played by Ray Fiennes in the movie, on his birthday, he wanted someone to play the piano for him, and so he asked her to play the Chopin. And evidently she played it so beautifully that him, who was probably one of the cruelest Nazis of all, who spared her life. And then in the case of Władysław Spielmann, he was the kind of the leading Chopin pianist in Poland prior to World War II and played on the radio. And his story it became the basis for the movie The Pianist. His whole family was exterminated. He was saved because he was a pianist. Someone recognized him in the extermination line and pulled him away and said no, you know, and saved him at that moment from being killed. The rest of the family then was sent off. And later, while he was in Warsaw after the uprising, he was discovered by a Nazi who then asked him to play for him. And Spielmann played once again this Nocturne in C sharp minor. And the Nazi was moved and saved his life and brought him food and kind of saw him through until the Russians got there.
I think that's one of the hardest things to understand about this period, this dichotomy between these people who love music and have this deep appreciation for beauty and in the same breath can appreciate the beauty and commit such heinous hatred at the same time.
Do we know how the music played in the camps by fellow prisoners impacted those who did not play? And who saw, I suppose, maybe these people getting, if not preferential treatment, being spared as others were going to the gas chamber?
Oh, absolutely. We have. Primo Levi writes about these infernal music that's sort of mocking them as they're marching off every morning to their work detail and then trying to drag themselves back and try to stay alive one more day and hear these jolly tunes. And so there is a sense that while the musicians are fellow prisoners and fellow Jews, that they are part of the camp machinery. Mm-hmm. And the musicians themselves felt that way. In fact, after the Holocaust, many of the musicians who played in those orchestras refused to ever play again.
Yes, that came out in the Violins of Hope a conversation that we had here, that many of them simply never – that's why the violins were donated, because they never touched them again.
Some of them, yes, absolutely.
Which is a very sad thing. the music in the camps obviously served the Nazis' purposes in a way, but in another way, I suppose, it also worked against them, didn't it? Because it does provide, if you're allowed to play familiar tunes that bring back memories of a normal life, either that normal life, either those memories are going to be sad because it doesn't exist anymore, or connect you to better times and therefore be able to fight off the oppression of the Nazis in the camps.
I think we need to remember that there's no single Jewish experience in the Holocaust.
Right, of course
not. It's not one story of 6 million. It's 6 million different stories. And so depending on where we are, that might be true. There's a case of a composer named Herbert Zipper who in Dachau actually put together a clandestine orchestra in one of the latrine buildings. And they'd play for a half hour every week and sort of filter people through just to give them a sense of normalcy.
How many schools get to see this?
I think last year we did about 16 performances. This year so far we've done 4. The program's readily available for anyone, and not just schools.
Not just schools.
No, I mean the program is not is in no way written on a school level. I mean, is appropriate for community groups and anyone who's interested in this program.
And it's a multimedia presentation.
Right. Yeah. It's narration. It's live music, and it's a slideshow.
Chris Donnell is the manager of education for the Charlotte Symphony. Dr. Jay Grimes, an associate professor of musicology at UNC Charlotte, and earlier today, Gene Cavadlo, who's the principal clarinetist with the symphony and the leader of Viva Klezmer. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.